This morning we're going to be dealing with the subjects of sorrow and suffering. And it's a huge privilege for me to be able to preach to you this morning, but the reason I am sort of ties directly to our topic, as my father was just talking about Pastor Zeger. We're very thankful that he is here, because things on Wednesday didn't look so good. They looked kind of grim. So when I was preparing for this, I was sort of preparing with the mindset that he might not be here come Sunday. So we're very thankful to God that he's okay, and that he's expected to have a full recovery. Nevertheless, I'd still like to try to shed some light on the subjects of sorrow and suffering, because the simple fact is that if you aren't suffering or have some sort of sorrow now, then you will, and it's critical that you know what the Bible has to say about it. Many of you are suffering right now with physical, mental, emotional ailments. So if that is you, then I hope that I can maybe bring you some encouragement and some conviction, and maybe even change your mind, how you think about your own sorrow, your own suffering. If not, then hopefully you can encourage someone else. So that's my hope and my prayer as we go forward this morning. So please follow along with me in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. "So to keep me from becoming conceited, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given to me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me." To keep me from becoming conceited. "Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong.'" Perhaps the part of that passage that rings in your ear the most, because you've heard it, we just sang the words in How Firm a Foundation, is, "My grace is sufficient for you." It may be a fairly simple concept to consider, but being convinced that God's grace is sufficient for you in your own weaknesses can seem impossible at times. However, we have the truth of God's word that tells us of so great a cloud of witnesses in Hebrews 12 that have remained steadfast in the midst of trial. And not only do we have biblical examples of men and women such as that, heroes of the faith, so to say, but we also have all those since Christ was on the earth, even till now. And I think a lot of the time as Christians, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot by spending the free time that we have listening, watching, or reading about the world's heroes when we have such an incredible library of them in our own faith. That's not to say that those who are not Christians haven't done great things, but we have there's such an asset to making a study of the lives of those who have come before us in the faith. So, this morning, I'd like us to get to know two of them in particular that tie very directly to this passage. So before we jump into the text that we just read, let's just go over the context a little bit of the passage so that we understand what exactly the Apostle Paul is saying in this section. You may recall that if you've read 1 Corinthians, that Paul's relationship to the church in Corinth wasn't always as smooth as Skippy Creamy Peanut Butter. 1 Corinthians is somewhat of an extended rebuke for the members of that church because of all the issues that were coming up there. There was sexual immorality in the church. There was pandemonium and crazy disorder in worship. There was a misuse of spiritual gifts. And probably most of all, there was a denying of, among some of them, of the resurrection of believers that had died. They were saying that they're just dead and that's it. But also, they were attacking Paul personally and saying that he was in the ministry for personal gain, for financial gain, and that, and this is the one that he is responding to in 2 Corinthians, that when he's with them, He's very shy and timid, and he's very humble. But then in his letters, he's kind of a jerk. He's like, you guys need to get it together. So they're saying that you know, when you write to us, you're mean, and when you are in our presence, then you're really nice. So Paul writes earlier, this is in chapter 10, I, Paul, myself entreat you, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold towards you when I am away. A lot of time when we're reading these letters, we miss the sarcasm. Paul's being totally sarcastic. He's saying like, oh yeah, because this is how I am. He's saying, you think of me like this, you know. So he writes this sarcastically because that's what they're saying. But then he turns it around to try to show the church at Corinth that what they see as his weakness is actually a strength. Because it's a strength that comes not from him, but it comes from God. He goes on comparing himself. I like the way the ESV puts this. I think I might be in the minority, but that's what I'm using. The way that it puts it is he compares it to the super apostles. He calls them super apostles who boast in what they consider to be their great abilities of speaking, their great depth of spiritual knowledge. So he boasts to them sarcastically, talking about the glamorous successes of his ministry. So what does he mention? He says beatings, persecutions, and at the end of chapter 11, his experience in Damascus of having the governor basically put out a search warrant for him, and he has to leave the city by getting let down in a basket from the city wall. So it's sort of like if, you know, someone was like, so Paul, how's your ministry in Damascus? And he's like, well, pretty good. The governor put out a search warrant because they wanted to kill me, and I had to leave the city by getting in a basket and letting down, and then I ran for my life, so pretty good. You know, it's like, it's totally sarcastic. He's saying, like, this is the glory, you know, of my ministry, basically. But then he's saying that this is what he is going to boast in. He's going to boast in these kind of things, you know, these things that the super apostles would never boast about because it doesn't fit with their goals. Their goal is financial gain, prestige, personal prestige. So he's saying, this is what I boast in. Sorry. At the end of chapter 12, he says, I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be, or sorry, beginning of chapter 12. If you're following along, this is verse 1. I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained by it. I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast, but on my own behalf, I will not boast except of my weaknesses. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it so that no one may think more of me than he sees of me or hears of me. So what he's essentially saying is this. Because he says, I know a man. He's talking about himself in the third person. So he said, you want to hear about something worth boasting about? I saw a vision of heaven that I can't even relate to you. I can't even describe to you. It was so crazy. It was so insane. But I'm not going to boast about it because I'm instead going to boast about my weaknesses, okay? Because then it's about what God does through me and not what I've seen, what I've done, what I've experienced. So in that context, we come back to our main text, starting in verse 7. So to me, to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given to me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Because there was a great danger of Paul becoming spiritually proud, he's given this thorn to keep him humble. Why is there a danger of him becoming proud? Well, because of what he just said. I saw this amazing vision of heaven. I got to see the place. I got to see the dwelling place of God. Okay, it'd be pretty easy for somebody to become conceited about that. Like, wow, you know, God, I am, you know, I'm God's man because look what he let me see. You know, just wow, I'm something else. I must be something else because God showed me this. So to keep him from becoming that way because of the danger of pride coming from this, he's given this thorn. Now, what is the thorn? Well, there's a number of speculations about what this thorn is. Probably it was some sort of physical defect. A lot of commentators and scholars think that it was possibly his failing eyesight. So he had his eyes were going bad. You know, he might have been completely blind, or going completely blind. I think we can understand how that would be like a thorn sort of in the side. It makes things very difficult. And I think you can sort of fill in the blank with whatever your physical problem is. If you're like me, you might put a really bad back. It limits me. It makes me have to rely on other people for certain things. You know, I worked my way through college doing tree removal. I'm still kind of doing it, which probably isn't good, but sorry. There we go. But I'm at least not supposed to anymore, you know, go and be lifting the big logs and do all this stuff. I need to rely on my workers to do that, because if I do it, I'm going to be in a lot of pain. I'm going to mess up my back even more. Which for me, as a man, fairly manly man at that, it's a big bruise on my pride, okay? Because I want to go to the gym and I want to pump iron. I want to be like Kenny. So, I see this as a thorn in my flesh to keep me from becoming conceited, because that's exactly what it does. It keeps me from being proud, because I can't be proud about that anymore. So, that's a thorn. And like I said, fill in the blank. You know, you have some sort of physical issue that's very debilitating. You know, put that in there. So another question that sort of begs to be answered from that verse is, how is this thorn? It says this thorn is a messenger of Satan. Okay, so it doesn't make any sense, right? That the whole point of the thorn is to make him to not be conceited, to keep him humble. Now, does Satan want him humble? Absolutely not. Satan wants him proud. So how can it be a messenger of Satan? Well, I think this is the key. But first, Job. Think of Job. Who afflicted Job? Satan afflicted Job. But who used that affliction to eventually bless Job beyond what he ever could have imagined? Well, God did. So Satan, in effect, we were talking about this in youth group. Satan, in effect, ends up working for God, okay? Because God, in his sovereignty, is working everything together for his plan. So Satan, in effect, is working for God, which is kind of a crazy idea. But Satan can't do anything about it. Neither can you. So I think Satan was a messenger in the sense that he attacked Paul in reference to this. Okay, so tried to get him to think about his shortcoming, about his weakness, in such a way that would sort of cripple him spiritually. It's not any different for us. You know, he would. Satan would use that to try him to doubt God's goodness, to think that he couldn't be used of God. And if you think of your own life, I think this is especially relevant for young people. You know, you think, I'm too short, I'm too tall, I'm not athletic enough, I'm not smart enough. To make it a little bit more real for those with physical problems, I'm in too much pain all the time, I can never be too far from a bathroom, I can't walk, or really serious, I have cancer, I only have a few months to live. You know, so in thinking on those things, we come to a point where we start thinking, God, you can't use me because of the burden that you've allowed to be put on me. You just, you know, if you hadn't put this burden on me, then you would be able to use me, but I'm out for the count because of what you've allowed, you know. And basically we blame God. We say, God, it's your fault. You allowed Satan to do this to me. Now you can't, If you were smart like me, that's the way that we end up thinking, then you would not have put this burden on me. But, you know, you did, so I can't be used. You know, there's no way you can use me unless my health improves, okay? That's the way we start thinking. So, and I think this goes beyond just physical problems. One that I was thinking about that's very especially common to the community of young adult men, it has to do with finding a spouse. And the message from Satan usually goes something like this. God, I can't serve you effectively without being joyful, because that's one of the fruits of the Spirit. And I can't be joyful without being happy. And I can't be happy unless this girl is in my life. And if she's not, Can't serve you. Thanks, Bob. Yeah. Okay, so we could go through a lot of examples, but I think you get the idea. Okay, it's a messenger from Satan in the sense that he's attacking in regards to that weakness. So, does Paul just immediately accept this affliction? No, he doesn't. It says in verse 8, three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. This statement intrigues me for a few reasons, but when I think back to when I had back surgery, it wasn't three times total, it was three times every half hour that I would like be like, God, please take this away. God, heal me as like a miracle. Just heal it up right now, and I'll be, then you can use me. Then I will be useful for you. It doesn't work that way all the time. So Paul, on three specific occasions, asks to please be relieved of this. But it says, what does it say in verse 9? But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. So let that sink in. I'll read it again. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. A sermon by Alistair Begg on this passage begins with this question. Have you ever considered the possibility that your limitations and weaknesses are actually the key to your usefulness in the service of the Lord Jesus Christ? And that's exactly where this passage takes us. What God said to Paul was that his grace was enough, just like we sing sometimes on Sunday morning. He wouldn't take the thorn out. It wasn't going to come out, but he would give him the steady supply of grace needed to get through it. Okay? And part of that was to keep him humble, remember? So, then he says, my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, this is a revolutionary thought. My power is made perfect in weakness. Your weaknesses and your limitations are actually more of an asset spiritually, in the spiritual sense, than your strengths, which is an absolutely backwards way of thinking for us. We don't think that way. Okay? It's the complete opposite of our natural way of thinking. In the world, our strengths are everything. Okay, they determine the level of value for us as people. You know, even if you're being affirmed and because we live in the self-esteem movement, so you're, no matter what, everyone gets a sticker, everyone gets an A, whatever it is, you are affirmed. But it doesn't really work that way, if you think about it, because who do we worship? Who do we admire? Well, we admire athletes, singers, people with great talent, people who make a lot of money. Those are the ones who are making the front pages of the news. So that's in the world, in the world's eyes, that determines the level of your value. Okay, but in a spiritual sense, it's actually the complete opposite. I was thinking, in the world, this actually gets to a ridiculous level with self-esteem, because then there's contradictory. You can believe two things at the same time that are strengths, but they contradict each other. One example I was thinking of is affirming a belief in evolution and affirming homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle. Because in an evolutionary worldview, your greatest good is passing on your genes sort of to the next generation so that you can continue to species can continue to evolve, but homosexuality makes that impossible, okay? So you have a contradiction. I mean, but everyone, it all has to be affirmed. It all has to be in our culture. You celebrate even something that is a weakness or should be considered a weakness by your own worldview as a strength, okay? So it gets crazy when you think about it. But what Paul is presenting here is the exact opposite of that. It's also the opposite of the super apostles, because remember, he's not talking about, his context is not about, he's not talking about, the secular Corinthians in the second. He's talking about people who are claiming to be Christians, but they're full of spiritual pride. But instead of glorifying ourselves by letting people know our strengths, we let people know our weaknesses, because it's through those weaknesses that God's grace is demonstrated. If you wonder about the truth of this, then just think about your life. Think about seasons of prosperity and plenty, and then compare it to seasons of, you know, strife and struggling. And I think most of you would probably say that it was those periods of strife and struggling that that's when you really felt the grace of God. Am I right? Maybe? Okay. Okay, so in the world, though, excuse me, in the world, struggling and limitations and weakness and pain and sorrow, the only thing you can really do with that is you can try to distract yourself. Okay, so you can use alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever to try to get you to not focus on that. Okay, but we have, again, the complete opposite in the body of Christ. The complete opposite is we boast in our weaknesses. We say, like, yeah, I have this problem, and God is gracious to me through it, and it's amazing. You know, I can't believe, like, how good he is to me, which just sounds ludicrous if you're not a follower of Christ. It just sounds ridiculous. So Paul goes on. He says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities, for when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Now, Paul's words here provide us with a great amount of comfort, okay? But don't get too comfortable in your comfort, because there are more than one kind of struggle that he goes over. Okay, so he goes over, he says, weaknesses, hardships, calamities, tough life circumstances that somebody has to weather. But you don't have to be a Christian to experience those, do you? No, you don't. You'll experience those no matter what, because your body will fail and you'll eventually die. And it's a slow process. It doesn't happen like that all the time. But he also says, what else does he say? He says, insults and persecutions. Those are things that only happen to you as you're following Christ, as you're sharing the gospel and you're proclaiming the gospel and you are trying to live a righteous life. That's the only time that those things happen to you, usually. So what does this mean? Well, first, it means that God's grace is sufficient for trials that come from walking the Christian walk, okay? So not just those physical problems and stuff. It's also sufficient when you're being persecuted. But it also means that while a great depth of God's grace is experienced through the weaknesses, the hardships, the calamities, an even greater amount of God's grace is experienced through insults and persecutions. Add that to the mix. Okay, so the more of these hardships that you're experiencing, the more grace you're experiencing too. Now, it also follows that despite Paul's physical limitation, okay, whatever the suffering might have been, it didn't slow him down. Okay, he was still charging full speed ahead. If anything, it didn't make him sort of just plop down and say, like, woe is me. It actually made him more urgent in his work, because a lot of the time suffering physically, okay, and I'm saying this partially from experience, you come to grips with the fact that your body is a ticking clock, and it's not going 1, 2, 3, it's going 3, 2, 1, okay, your time is very limited, and when you're sick or you're in pain, you dwell on that more, because especially if you're a Christian, you know, Paul says, I don't remember exactly where it is, but he says, you know, it would be better for me to go home and be with Christ than it would be to stay here. And I think part of the reason is he's suffering. He's suffering quite a bit. So that is much more preferable to what he's going through now. So suffering physically, you sort of have a, that's an asset in that you are able to be more focused sometimes on your spiritual goals, on the mission, okay, and not get distracted as much, because you're thinking about, like, you know what, I can't wait for this to be over. You know, I'm going to keep on, like, struggling through, but this, you know, I'm just passing through here. So hopefully the disorder of your body reminds you of this, puts the focus back where it should be. Now, practically speaking, how are your weaknesses strengths through God's grace? Okay, what does this mean in a practical sense? I think we've all heard, every time, you know, you're going through something and a Christian brother or sister comes to you and says, like, well, you know, they remind you of James 1, right? They say, you know, suffering produces steadfastness. Trials produce steadfastness. And that's absolutely true, and we should be reminded of that constantly. But I think there's another part to this that we miss so often, that we don't, that it somehow just slips through, and we don't acknowledge it all the time as much. I think it's this. As I mentioned at the beginning of the message, I think we miss out a great deal by not looking into the lives of some of those who have gone before us, okay? And I think exactly what Paul is talking about, okay? Especially, I think of pioneer missionaries, okay? I mentioned in the my prayer during the missions moment, but I think of pioneer missionaries especially because they went out... And what a lot of the things that they experienced, and Paul was a pioneer missionary too. He's going to places that the gospel has never reached before. Okay, so pioneer missionaries a lot of the time their lives sort of parallel in a lot of ways what Paul is talking about here. This is one of the things I love about reading missionary biographies. I always find myself so spiritually blessed by going through them, especially reading journal entries, especially reading journals, because you get sort of, you're able to see that these people were human. They weren't super Christians, okay? And that's very encouraging to me. It's nice to know that those who I look up to in the faith weren't super apostles. They were just believers who served a God with sufficient grace. And and I'd like to just look real quick. I see Kenny already put it up, but at the lives of two missionaries that I think tie very, very well into. And I think the church in America is failing miserably at educating on church history and the lives of the Reformation history, all these things. So I think the more that we can get into our Sunday worship, the better, because these are things that can be such an asset to you, you know, the studying the lives of these people. So these are two men that have been very influential in my life. And I hope maybe they can inspire you a little bit too. First, let's look at the life of David Brainerd. Okay, David Brainerd was born in Haddam, Connecticut, only about a 2 hours drive from here. His father was a town council member of Haddam who had 9 children, David being the third. Both his parents died by the time he was 14, and it's partly due to this that David said he was usually sober and inclined to melancholy, is the way he put it. So he was kind of despondent. He was kind of in his inner spiritual life, he was kind of depressive. He just tended toward that. And that was one of the reasons why losing his parents. He worked as a farmer in Connecticut until age 21, and then he was accepted to Harvard. He studied there till he was 23, but he was expelled for misconduct. Now, the reason why might surprise you when you think about what people get expelled for today. There was a situation where he was in a private conversation. He was asked about one of the tutors at the college, one of the faculty tutors, what he thought of them. And he said, he has no more grace than his chair. Okay? A minor insult, right? Okay? Somehow this got back to the rector of the college, who met with the college council and told David that he needed to make a confession to the whole student body. But while David apologized for what he had said, he refused to make a public apology for something that was said privately. So he was expelled. He was he spent the rest of his short life trying to become reconciled to the college, but he never was. And actually, just as a side note, his expulsion from Harvard actually ended up a bunch of people got very upset about it because they thought it was very unreasonable, and there was reform basically in the school, in the colleges, in the mid 1700s, so that kind of thing wouldn't happen again. But this tormented him. This was a very, you know, he probably cared a little bit about what these people thought of him, and so he was very, you know, to be expelled from a college is a pretty big deal. So he struggled with this a lot. But despite this, he still wanted to serve the Lord. He had studied divinity at Harvard, and so he had some training, and he wanted to become a missionary to the Native Americans. So he became licensed by the Scottish Society for Propagating Christian Knowledge, which was a missions society. They just had much more elaborate names back then, I think, because probably most people's vocabulary was a little bit higher because they read for what they read and stuff, and we're hearing all the time, so I like that, Scottish Society for Propagating Christian Knowledge. So that was the name of the missionary society. And he first became a missionary to natives in Nassau, New York, so not too far from here, and then in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and then a year later on the forks of the Delaware River. So he actually traveled the same roads that we drive, 84, you know, he was, back when it was dirt, you know, he was on a horse riding around here. So he traveled the same roads that we do all the time, which for me is really cool. I love thinking about, like, local history and all that. But almost till his death, 5 years later, he labored among the Delaware tribe, so that's south of here, towards New Jersey. And he kept very detailed journals so that he could report back to his mission society that had licensed him. And he made a very big impact on the tribe. A lot of them came to Christ. And when he died, actually, his brother ended up going and taking over for him because there was still a lot of work to do. But he, reading his journals, you know, he talks about his evangelistic efforts and preaching them, and he sort of just went, and anybody he could find, you know, usually they would get, because a European comes in, so they would sort of gather, you know, to hear what he would have to say. So he would often have a pretty captive audience, which was probably very convenient. But David had a problem. He was dying of tuberculosis through all this, through these few years. And tuberculosis is a very debilitating disease. It kills you, but it kills you very slowly. So it's like you slowly suffocate. His journal is very detailed, so he talks about, you know, exactly what he's experiencing. You know, he's waking up and he's coughing up blood, and it's hard to read in a lot of ways, and it affects him mentally and emotionally and spiritually, as you would understand. You know, if you think about physical problems that you've gone through, it's very very hard way to live. So eventually he had to leave because he was just too weak to work anymore, and he went to the house of Jonathan Edwards, who may be familiar. He wrote the famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and was one of the sort of architects of the Great Awakening in the mid-1700s. So he went to the church, or to the house of Jonathan Edwards to be taken care of, and he was nursed by Edwards' daughter, Jerusha, who... it seems he was probably in love with, but he died a short time after being at the house, and then she contracted the disease while taking care of him. So it ends up being one of the most, like, heartbreaking, like, saddest love stories you've ever read, and it's nearly impossible to read without a dry eye, but that's for another time, and not Valentine's Day. The point is here's a young man who's very burdened for the lost, who spent his short life in basically constant misery. But he finished his course while in great pain with a lot of peace. You know, if you read his few entries before, and Jonathan Edwards published his diary, so there's a commentary all through it. So he's commenting because he was there for his sort of last few months of life. And towards the end, you know, he gets very peaceful. He's ready to go, and he dies. Now, the first time I read this diary, I was very inspired by his testimony, but I was kind of left wondering in the back of my mind, why did God put such a burden on a man who could have been used so much more without the burden? And that ties back to what I said earlier, the question that we ask in our mind, like, Lord, if I didn't have this burden, then I would be able to serve you, but you've put this burden on me, so I can't do it. And that was my thinking. Why would God, you know, use this man, but only for a short time, because he died, because he was dying, and he was miserable, he was suffering. Then I read about Henry Martyn. And let me just, I'm getting a little behind here. So his need for sufficient grace, loss of his parents at age 14, expulsion for Harvard, tuberculosis, and then naturally he was just very sort of despondent, so kind of down. So he needed that sufficient grace very much so. So Henry Martyn. Henry Martyn was born in 1781, so 39 years after David Brainerd died, His father was a poor miner, and Henry didn't receive much of an education, but through self-study, eventually, he was able to earn a scholarship to Oxford. He became a Christian through the testimony of his sister. His sister was very devout, and she prayed for him incessantly that he would come to know Christ. And he did. Partly was through the death. He was very affected by the death of his father, much like David Brainerd. Now, he sometime during when he was in his late teens, early 20s, he heard reports coming from William Carey. And if you know something about pioneer missions, William Carey was the first missionary to India, the first Western missionary to India, and really the first for most of India, the first gospel influence ever. Okay, and he had a very very difficult journey. William Carey did. It was 8 years before anyone even before he baptized anybody into the faith. So, but William Carey was writing back to England and saying, "We need people. Come, you know, like there's a huge mission field and people, you know, God will do the work here, but we need workers." So, Henry was very inspired by this, but Henry got a copy of the diary of David Brainerd because it was in circulation in London. Jonathan Edwards, as I said, had published it. So he gets a copy of this, and David Brainerd becomes his role model, basically. I wouldn't say he modeled his life after David Brainerd, maybe purposely, but basically his life becomes like almost, you know, an exact like replica of Brainerd's life. And he mentions Brainerd a lot in his diary as sort of his inspiration. So, where was I? Okay, so he believed very much that he was called to missions, and he wanted to go, but he had a problem. He was madly in love with Lydia Grenfell, and he wanted to marry her, but she wouldn't leave England. So, what did he do? He left. He left without her, and this became his thorn in the flesh. As he was over there, he's constantly writing back to her, and back then it would be you write a letter, you wait a year. So he proposes marriage over and over. He wants her to be his wife. You know, he really, really loves her, but she doesn't want to leave England, and he's saying, I will make life as comfortable as possible. You know, he's willing to make sacrifices just because he really, really wants her to be with him, but she won't go. So, and think of it like, you know, you send a letter, you wait a year, you come back, it's a no. You've been waiting a whole year. Let that sink in. Think about how much that would affect you, you know, waiting all this time. So, Henry goes to India. He's there for several years, but he also travels to Bangladesh. He goes to Singapore. He's trying to translate the Bible. He's a naturally very timid, shy, but friendly. He's not a confrontational guy. You know, he's not looking to go, you know, he's not this guy who's looking to just go and I'm going to preach to the masses and I'm going to, you know, he finds preaching and talking very, takes a toll on his health because he's already not a very healthy. He's built small and kind of scrawny, and so he finds speaking and all that very, very difficult on his body. So he much preferred the scholarly work of trying to translate the Bible into the various languages. But he has another problem. When he arrives in India, actually Bangladesh, I believe, he's told, oh yeah, well, you know, the language changes every 4 miles. So you translate the Bible here, 4 miles away, different language. And so he goes, oh no, now what? What am I going to do? So he starts working on a translation into Sanskrit. Okay, Sanskrit is like the Eastern version of Latin, what Latin used to be for the Western world. You know, so you used to be able to go to Spain and Italy, and you could communicate in Latin. That was sort of the language of study. So in the East, and still in a lot of places, Sanskrit was the study language. So he tries to translate the Bible into Sanskrit, and he makes a lot of progress, but his problem is that he's not built for the climate. So he's very sick all the time. He's very hot, very humid. So he goes to Persia. And his plan now is he's going to make a translation of the Bible into Persian. But, as I said, he's a naturally unconfrontational person, which is not great when you're among Muslims, okay? Because there wasn't really anybody else. You know, it's not like he had a body of Christ that he was going to. It's not like he was going to a church. There was nobody. They're all Muslims. And the Muslims, they're familiar with Christianity. They were sort of trained apologists. So as soon as he gets there, he just has people constantly, you know, just coming wanting to argue with him. You know, why do you believe this? Why do you believe this? Why do you believe this? And he doesn't want to fight with them. He just wants to translate the Bible. Here you go. Read it for yourself. God's going to do the work, and I'm out. Okay? So that's what he was trying to do. Now, unfortunately, in Persia, it's still very hot, and his health declines. He actually, he made plans to go back to England, but he ends up dying on the way. Surrounded by people who don't like him. So he, and you read the last few journal entries right before he died, you know, he's very peaceful, but it's also, you know, he's talking about he's laying there, he's asking for help, he's got a burning fever, he's aching, you know, he feels like death, and they're not even paying attention to him. So he's sort of suffering alone. He, one particular entry, he says they're in a tent, and he climbs outside the tent to get his head outside, just his head get outside so that it's cooler, and then he can sleep, you know, but nobody's giving him any help. So he dies, but right before he dies, he finishes the translation into Persian, and this is the entry from around the time he brings the New Testament to the, it was the New Testament that he translated, he brings the New Testament to the king of Persia, and he says, "My book, which I had brought, expecting to present it to the king, lay before Mirza Shufi," that's the king. "As they all rose up after him to go, after the king and some away, I was afraid they would trample upon the book," because they just left it sitting there. "So I went to it and I wrapped it in a towel," and it says, "while they looked at it and me with supreme contempt. Thus I walked away alone to my tent to pass the rest of the day in heat and dirt. What have I done, I thought, to merit all this scorn? Nothing, I trust, but bearing testimony to Jesus. I thought over these things in prayer and found the peace which Christ hath promised." Okay, so not very difficult. You know, we go to work and we're trying to share the gospel with people. Much, much, much more difficult circumstances that he's in. So he died a short time later. But even you know, leaving it at that entry, you might sort of get the idea, wow, you know, he sort of just picked himself up and he was, you know, just fine with everything. But here's another entry. This is from the day that he turned 30. And this is a little bit more shaking. He says, "This day," this is while he's working on the translation, "this day I finished the 30th year of my unprofitable life, at the age at which David Brainerd finished his course. I'm now at the age at which the Savior of men began his ministry, and at which John the Baptist called the nation to repentance. Hitherto, I have made my youth and insignificance an excuse for sloth and imbecility. Now let me have a character and act boldly for God." Now, I share this last entry not to depress you, but to show that he was just as depressed, just as despondent as you are at times. Okay? But he served a great and gracious God, whose grace was sufficient for him. You may be wondering, how was God's grace sufficient for him? Did he die a failure or a success? Sorry. Leaving with this particular entry, it may seem like failure, right? Because he's in the middle of his life. You know, he's still pretty young. He's only 31 when he dies. Let's go to the next slide. There we go. But Henry and David both believed very strongly in the sovereignty of God. Now, when we're talking about everything that I've been talking about this morning, none of it works unless you believe in the sovereignty of God. Because he believed, David and Henry both believed, that they didn't believe, that the success or failure of their life was dependent upon their goals. They believed that it was dependent upon the plan that God had for them. Okay? So if we live our lives thinking that the success or failure of our lives is based on the goals that we accomplish, guess what? We're going to be disappointed. We're going to be depressed. We're going to be discouraged. And we may despair. And we may despair in our weaknesses. You know, God, why have you made me this way? Why have you let this happen to me? Why have you... Why have you made things just so difficult? Why can't it be easier for me? Unless you believe in the sovereignty of God, and not just as a passing thought, but you meditate on it and you really, really believe it, then you will be met with despair. Because this enables, believing in this doctrine enables you to persevere, to keep going. And that's exactly what my two examples, bringing the lives of these two men up, is that they persevered. And they did so because they believed in the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God is the gasoline in the engine of Christian perseverance. Henry believed in William Carey's missions motto, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. And he did. He did attempt great things for God, and it cost him his life. But think of the reward that he came home to. He died a young man, but he was living for the world to come, not for this one. So to tie the lives of these men back to our passage, we read that God's power is made perfect in weakness. But the power of weakness extended beyond their own lives. Martin was inspired by the strength of Brainerd's weaknesses. Okay, it wasn't because he wasn't inspired by, wow, Brainerd sure did a lot of amazing things. It wasn't that. It was Brainerd did all this work while he was dying. That's what inspired him. So, what about you? Do you see the strength in your weaknesses? Do they drive you to the foot of the cross to rely on God? Do you see the purposes in your sorrow and in your suffering? Most importantly, do you know the Savior that makes your weaknesses your strengths? Or does the sorrow and suffering of your life just leave you in despair? Maybe you do know Him, but you're letting the enemy get a foothold in your life by getting you to believe the lie that God can't use you because of your sorrow, your suffering, or your weakness. Maybe you need to start asking Him how He can use you through your struggles and shortcomings. And I'd like to close by reading this third verse of the hymn that we're about to sing. Julie, if you'd like to get ready. Be still, my soul, when dearest friends depart. And I might just, real quick as a side note, add, Henry Martin, when he left for India, his journal entry right before he leaves is almost desperate. It's just because as he sees it, he's leaving for India. He's never going to see his family again. He's extremely close to his sister. He's in love with this girl. But he says, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but God's grace is going to be sufficient for me, and I would rather serve God than live regretting that I had. So I'll just finish this verse. Be still, my soul, when dearest friends depart, and all is darkened in the veil of tears. Then shalt thou better know His love, His heart, who comes to soothe thy sorrow and thy fears. Be still, my soul, thy Jesus can repay from His own fullness all He takes away. If you'd stand, please, we're going to sing this song as we close.